Hello and thanks for joining us for this WTTW News special. I'm Brandis Friedman. Here's what we're looking at.
What President Trump is doing is unprecedented and unwarranted.
Local officials are calling out President Trump's push to send the National Guard to Chicago.
Next should be Chicago, because as you all know, Chicago's a killing field.
And while the president calls Chicago a killing field, we delve into what the statistics actually show. Tonight, the latest in our focus on police and policing in Chicago. This month's edition of our ongoing project comes at a critical time as the president of the United States calls out crime in Chicago, despite data showing it's dropping. Governor J.B. Pritzker sounded the alarm today about President Donald Trump's threats to deploy federal troops to Chicago. Trump did hedge on the timing today, but is adamant the city needs federal action. Pritzker, along with Mayor Brandon Johnson and a plethora of local leaders, gathered to dismiss Trump's latest pledge to combat crime as a cover for an unconstitutional federal overreach.
This is not about fighting crime. This is about Donald Trump searching for any justification to deploy the military in a blue city, in a blue state, to try and intimidate his political rivals.
We believe that you don't solve crime by sending in the military. We are being targeted because of who we are as a city more than anything else.
Our Heather Sharon was at that afternoon news conference and she joins us now from downtown. Heather, so Governor J.B. Pritzker, we know, had some very strong words for the president. What did he tell him?
Well, he said it clearly and unambiguously to the president. Chicago neither wants nor requires the assistance of the National Guard in fighting crime. And in fact, Governor J.B. Pritzker, in the strongest possible language, sounded an alarm about American democracy, as we heard, saying that this was nothing but an attempt by the president to punish his political foes. And of course, he has targeted Chicago repeatedly, dating all the way back to 2016, and has shown no sign of letting up.
Pretty strong show of force behind the governor and the mayor there, Heather. Every Democrat elected, lots of clergy as well. Pritzker, he told reporters that Illinois officials are determined to do everything possible to stop the deployment of soldiers, but what can he do to actually stop that deployment if the president should give the order?
So there's not really anything the governor can do. He told reporters that the president has the authority under federal law to federalize the National Guard and send it to Chicago. However, at the same time, he raised the specter of legal action, saying that Illinois would do everything possible to keep its citizens safe from essentially a military occupation. However, Attorney General Kwame Ruhle acknowledged that there's not really a plan to file a preemptive lawsuit because it's not clear what specific law the president will invoke or exactly how the state can combat that in court.
And Heather, if the president does deploy the National Guard, what are state and local officials, how would they respond and what would they tell residents to do?
Well, I asked Mayor Johnson exactly that question, telling him that I had heard from Chicagoans who are really worried that the presence of the National Guard in Chicago could disrupt their lives, their ability to go to school, to take the CTA, to go to work. And he didn't have any specifics to offer, saying only that the city and the state had joined forces to put their arms around all residents of Chicago. But the governor, he painted a bleak picture if this deployment happens, saying that this will be a difficult time. And if necessary, he called on people to protest peacefully, while at the same time warning governors of other states not to allow their National Guards to be deployed to Illinois, and saying that he would be taking names if anyone violated the rights of who he called his people.
Okay, Heather Sharon, downtown Chicago for us, thank you.
Thank you, Brandis.
And you can read Heather's full story on our website. It's all at WTTW.com/news. And up next, we'll dig more into the city's crime data to see what it actually shows and explore how public dollars are being spent to enhance public safety.
WTTW News coverage of policing and police reform is supported by the Joyce Foundation.
President Trump's deployment of troops in Washington, D.C. may be making its way to Chicago. He's threatening to deploy the National Guard here, saying crime is out of control and that he doesn't believe reports that violence is down, despite statistics to the contrary. Here to talk about what we really know about crime trends, as well as the most effective ways to spend public funds to increase public safety, we're joined by Aaron Gottlieb, who runs the Resource Allocation Lab, which studies the best ways to deploy public resources to affect public safety. He's an associate professor at the University of Chicago. Catherine Bocanegra, assistant professor at University of Illinois Chicago, who works in the areas of community violence prevention and criminal justice reform. David Olson, a Loyola University Chicago professor of criminal justice and criminology, who is co-director of Loyola's Interdisciplinary Center for Criminal Justice Research. And joining us via Zoom from the nation's capital is Michael Negron, senior fellow for economic opportunity at the Center for American Progress, who was an aide to President Biden, Governor Pritzker, and former Mayor Rahm Emanuel. We should mention we did invite the Chicago Police Department to join our discussion this evening, but they declined. I'm thankful to the four of you for joining us. So we mentioned the data that the president says he does not believe. Chicago police data shows that compared to last year, violent crime in the city is down 22% compared to last year. There have been 36% fewer shootings, and homicides are also down 32%. There have been some other crimes that have fallen as well. David Olson, over to you first. President Trump, as we said, he's doubted these crime stats. Is there, how do you make the case? How does one make the case that, you know, for Chicago being in a state of emergency to warrant the deployment of troops that he is calling for?
Yeah, I think with crime statistics, there's a lot of different ways that they can be interpreted. I think the idea that crime is up is the first place to start. Is crime up? The statistics from the Chicago Police Department indicate that they're not. But the important thing about looking at crime and levels of crime is if even if crime is down, if the public's perception is such that it isn't, then it may not matter, right? If the public still thinks it's going up or that it's at a high level, obviously public concern isn't swayed by statistics that suggest otherwise. I think in the case of Chicago and in Illinois, one of the benefits is for the most serious crimes like homicides and shootings and things like that, those crimes tend to get reported the most by the public. But we also have other sources of information we can look at to gauge whether or not those trends are consistent. So not only can we look at the Chicago Police Department's figures on shootings and homicides, we can look to the Illinois Department of Public Health that tracks emergency room admissions for shootings, as an example. The drop in shootings treated in emergency rooms is exactly the same size as the drop in shootings that the Chicago Police Department is reporting. So when we have the benefit of multiple sources of information and they all point to the same thing, they're collected by different levels of government, different agencies, that gives us a little bit more reassurance that these figures are accurate. The other thing is what's happening in Chicago is happening in a lot of other large cities, right? So it's not just Chicago that's seeing a drop in homicides and shooting, it's other large cities. So I think that's one thing that's important. And the other thing that I think we're at a unique point in history for is we know how much crime occurred in Chicago last month. When I started my career, we would know how much crime there was this year, 3 years from now, right? Because it was all manual, it took a long time to assemble the data, there wasn't computerization of records. So historically, elected officials could say crime was going up or going down. There was no way to ever verify or ascertain whether or not that was accurate. But today, it's a little bit different.
Yeah. So the data that we have now is much more reliable than the data we might have had 15 to 20 years ago.
And much more timely.
Absolutely. Yeah. Go ahead, Catherine.
And I would just like to build on what Dave said, in that Chicago's traditionally had a public safety gap in that the rates of violence victimization across communities has been unequal. The burden of violence and victimization in the city has been borne by Black and Latino communities. And so when you look at those aggregate statistics, the 30% or something reduction in shootings and homicides, I think it's important to ask the question if those who are at the epicenter of violence, who feel it most acutely, if they are experiencing those reductions. And so Chicago has a really great tool, the Violence Reduction Dashboard. I encourage everyone to check it out. And earlier today, I looked at the shooting and homicide rates in the communities that have traditionally been framed as having the highest rates of violence, like Austin and Roseland and Little Village. And I looked at the reductions, and if they compare, if they're on par with the average that you just stated, or if there have been even greater gains in public safety. And in the communities that have traditionally been disproportionately burdened with violence and victimization, we're seeing if the same, the average amount of reductions in shootings and homicides, if not greater gains in public safety, right? So greater reductions in shootings and homicides. So those who've traditionally been harmed the most are experiencing the greatest gains in safety.
Okay, that's an important point. Thank you for mentioning that, Catherine. So Aaron, what does the evidence show are the outcomes of having increased law enforcement presence? And to be clear, National Guard, they are not law enforcement. They serve a different function.
Yeah, so I mean, I guess, so in general, with law enforcement, there is evidence that increased law enforcement does lead to reductions in crime. But often the way the evidence works is we don't account for the possible trade-offs, right? So there are limited local government resources that are spent. So if you're just looking at what's the impact of adding one police officer without considering what is being taken away, you might find one thing. But in a study I just conducted looking at the 50 most populous counties in the Great Lakes region, which equates to having 200,000 people or more, what I found with colleagues was that when you reallocate resources away from the criminal legal system towards other services, you don't see any change in the homicide rate, but what you do see is a significant reduction in the suicide rate. So one thing, and I'm happy to talk about that more, but one thing that I think is critical is when we talk about public safety, we often only think about crime, and that is really important. Crime is critical, but I would argue that it's important to take a holistic view of public safety and well-being and to think about things like health, mental health, educational outcomes, socioeconomic outcomes, et cetera. So from my perspective, when we think about how we invest resources, we should be thinking about crime, but we should also be thinking about those other things.
Of course. Catherine, what are the strategies, just to go ahead and get this out there, what are the strategies that we know of that work to reduce crime?
Sure. So just building off of what Dr. Gottlieb shared, I think a holistic definition or approach to safety expands upon the traditional notion of policing and punishment. So a more holistic, comprehensive approach to safety includes investing in community violence intervention programs. It includes economic development, jobs, and housing that creates thriving businesses that reduces family instability and desperation. And it includes a public health approach and trauma recovery services that get at the root causes of violence in communities. So that's what a holistic definition looks like. Now, we actually can put a dollar amount on public safety, the public safety issues that are being highlighted in the media right now. Labor economists have calculated the average cost for a shooting and a homicide in Chicago, all right? They estimate, this is based on a randomized control trial of the Ready Chicago model.
At the Heartland Alliance.
Yes, the Heartland Alliance, a community violence intervention initiative. So labor economists have estimated that a shooting costs upward around $180,000 and a homicide costs taxpayers around upwards of $900,000. And those costs come in the victim costs, so like the medical bills, emergency response, long-term health care, lost income for families, and the trauma that occurs. But it also is a cost that is associated with the person who caused the harm. All right, so the court costs, the prison costs, and the lost productivity of when people are incarcerated. When we invest in community-based strategies, such as the evidence-based Ready Chicago model, there is, for every $1 invested in a community-based strategy targeting those high-risk individuals, labor economists have estimated a $4 to $18 return on investment in those avoided costs.
Okay, I thank you for the numbers, because that says something, doesn't it? And then there's the cost of deploying National Guard troops, which Michael Negron, I know that you've got some information on that for us. What do we know about the cost of the direct cost of deploying National Guard troops to a city like Chicago?
Well, we have a laboratory in Washington, D.C. right now, and we had a similar deployment to Los Angeles earlier this year. And there's, you know, I think there's two important things when we think about economic development and a strong economy, and that's business community, consumers. They look for a public safety, of course, which we're talking about here, but also stability and predictability in policymaking. And what the administration is doing right now is not going to contribute to public safety based on what we've seen in Washington, where we have a police officer, or the National Guardsmen in the tourist areas and the National Mall and Georgetown by the Nationals Park, which is a baseball stadium, and not in the communities where there's actually a crime issue. And then while that's happening, business foot traffic, so retailers are reporting less foot traffic, restaurant reservations are quite down, were quite down in the first week. They've started to rebound a bit this week as it was restaurant week this past week. But we're seeing some early bad indicators of business activity. And the cost of this, well, we don't yet know the cost in Washington. The 60-day deployment in the state of California in Los Angeles, that was 5,000 National Guardsmen for 60 days. It was more than $130 million, which is a big public expenditure for something that, according to Governor Newsom, they released some information as well as a study by the University of California, Merced. They found that attendance at work was down 3% since the deployment, that the combination of the deployment to LA as well as other immigration policies is set to shrink the California economy by about $300 billion. That's about 5% of the California economy. And so if you look at Washington, D.C., where folks have been deterred from going to restaurants and going to retailers, you look at the effects in California, it's not really looking like a good use of public money given the economic impacts. People like certainty, businesses like certainty, and if the president is talking about deploying soldiers to a major American city for an undetermined amount of time and not being clear how those soldiers are going to interact with the population, a lot of people are going to just decide to skip out on coming into the city for a meal or for a show. There may be conventions, business trade groups that decide to not do a convention or to cancel the convention because they're uncertain about whether the commute or the travel is going to be easy, or there going to be demonstrations. And so this is just creating a good bit of uncertainty for the business community and for consumers, and that's just not a good recipe for the economic success of a city. And it's not really, doesn't really justify what could end up being hundreds of millions of dollars at the beginning in taxpayer cost, let alone if this becomes just a new way of doing business where we're looking at 3 years of this, then you're talking about billions or tens of billions.
Of course, and it sounds like, as you're saying, there's of course the direct cost of deploying soldiers, guardsmen and women, but then there's also the indirect cost and the impact that it has on businesses around the area and in the city. But, you know, we mentioned earlier in the show the president referring to the city of Chicago as a, quote, killing field. Here's a little bit more of what the president said about Chicago in the Oval Office today.
Next should be Chicago, because as you all know, Chicago is a killing field right now. And they don't acknowledge it. And they say, we don't need him. Freedom, freedom. He's a dictator. He's a dictator. A lot of people are saying maybe we like a dictator. I don't like a dictator. I'm not a dictator. I'm a man with great common sense, and I'm a smart person.
David Olson, about crime statistics and trends in their calculation, how accurate a picture does that data give to the complexity of crime in the city of Chicago?
I think it doesn't always give a good sense of the nature of crime. The crime that we're most fixated on, obviously, is the most serious crime. That's homicide. It's also the best measured. It's also the measure that we have the most confidence is accurate. But most crime is not violent, right? Most crime is minor crime, oftentimes not even resulting in people calling the police because it's not serious, right? There's no injury, there's no threat. So I think the challenge is that from the public standpoint, there's only one type of crime they ever hear about, right? It's the most serious, it's what is the headlines. And oftentimes for a lot of people, it's that crime that shapes their understanding of what crime is, right? So that if they hear that someone who was accused of a crime wasn't sentenced to prison, they're equating that to murder cases, right? When It might be a simple drug possession case. It might be a simple theft case. So that's one of the challenges. It's obviously the crime that people are most concerned about, is what gets the most attention, but oftentimes it's that crime that creates people's perception of what crime is, and how we should respond to crime is based on what they perceive crime being, and that's the most serious. And that's what, you know, over the last 30 or 40 years, as the public's view of crime equates to the most serious, they historically have demanded for more and more punitive policies, which trickles down to people charged with drug possession and theft, right? They equate all those to the most serious crimes. I think at least in Illinois and a number of other states, over the last 15 to 20 years, we've really started to better understand, one, what is the nature of crime, and what is the most effective response to it. You know, the things that Catherine described are the things that occur outside of the justice system that may be much more efficient a use of resources. And we've seen that in Illinois, that we're relying less on prison in Illinois as a response to crime. And it's not just a Chicago approach or the former state's attorney's approach, Kim Fox. It's across Illinois that prosecutors are using prison less. Why? Because they realize that prison for someone charged with drug possession and theft isn't efficient. It's a lot of money, and it doesn't address the problem.
And that's been a big shift. It's taken two, three decades to get to that point for, you know, law enforcement officials to start to shift their thinking. Aaron, should officials be completely, you know, or considering a completely different funding model to approach public safety? And what would that look like?
So that's a great question. So, I mean, I think right now we've done things a certain way. Basically forever.
For a long time,
And like the way we've approached addressing crime has been through punishment and through policing. I do think that there's increasingly good evidence that we would be well served reallocating some of those resources to the types of community investments that Catherine is talking about. I do think that's a process that will take a lot of time. And it's something that we need to go about incrementally because we also need the infrastructure in place to make sure that those investments are successful. Right now, we certainly, I mean, the amount we're investing in the traditional forms of public safety are just exponentially greater than the amount we're investing in these community investments.
Michael Negron, do you think the political will to do something like that even exists?
Well, I think it's clear that it doesn't exist under this administration at the moment. This is an administration that has frozen more than $150 million in community violence intervention grants. And it's doing this at a time when it just passed a budget bill that will cut more than $1 trillion to Medicaid and to SNAP programs across the country. And so this is an administration that has not been making the types of investments that we've been talking about on this panel. And in fact, it has been taking an axe, a chainsaw, if you talk to Elon Musk, to the safety net that really undergirds all of this and is really a starting point. And so when you talk about perception, it is true that things can always be better when it comes to violence reduction. But we've seen enough progress that tourism in 2024 was the highest it had been since 2019. The Chicago area continues to be the top market for corporate and headquarters relocations. So there are things that are happening with this economy that are going well, and it's a suspect time in the name of public safety to be taking measures that, based on what we're seeing elsewhere, are actually going to undermine the economy, and that just means less revenue to support the types of public safety investments that we really need that will help prevent crime.
Catherine, we've got less than a minute left. You know, you gave us a lot of numbers earlier showing that even in the communities that typically experience the most crime, even they are sharing the crime reduction that the city is seeing on the average. How significant is that, given the city's long-standing battle with crime?
I think it's incredibly significant. Now, I know listening to this this newscast right now, there is a family that's been impacted by violence. So I want to make sure that when I talk about reductions, it's not overlooking the people who have been impacted, who are currently impacted, and the ripple effects in their community. But the fact that we are seeing reductions is inspiring hope and renewal and recovery in the communities that for so long have been overlooked.
That is where I'm going to leave it because I think that's the best place that we can leave it, is that there is hope, obviously work to be done still. And thanks to the three of you for studying, or four of you, excuse me, for studying this important work. Aaron Gottlieb, Catherine Bocanegra, David Olson, and Michael Negron. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
And we're back to wrap things up right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Jim and Kay Mabee family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
And that's our show for this Monday night. Be sure to sign up for our free email newsletter, The Daily Chicagoan, at WTTW.com/newsletter. And join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 10. Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a personal injury law firm working to preserve the dignity and rights of all individuals.